From New York, this is Democracy Now!
America first does not mean America alone. To the contrary, it is a call for deeper collaboration and mutual respect among trade partners.
Trump blinks. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent appears to be trying to de-escalate the global trade war that Trump launched just weeks ago. As the Dow Jones is on pace for its worst April since the Great Depression, we'll speak with the American Prospect's Robert Kuttner on Trump's trade war and Trump's attacks on news organizations, including CBS. This week, the head of CBS's 60 Minutes quit, saying the show's independence is compromised. Plus, we speak to the Nobel Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa about the global fight for press freedom and the death of Pope Francis. She recently spoke at the Vatican.
Technology rewards. Rewards lies. Think about that. The first time I met Pope Francis, I said, Pope Francis, it's against the Ten Commandments.
Then to Trump's war on children.
A range of federal agencies that not a lot of people know about, like the Children's Bureau and the Office of Family Assistance. The Trump administration has been cutting programs and services for children, including child support enforcement and resources for investigating child abuse and child protection services.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, the Palestinian Ministry of Health reports Israeli attacks killed 50 people and wounded more than 150 others over the past 24 hours. Among the dead are three Palestinians who were killed when an Israeli drone struck a food distribution center in central Gaza. On Wednesday, Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir claimed during a visit to the U.S. that top Republican lawmakers support the policy of bombing food and humanitarian aid depots in Gaza. After he was feted at a dinner in his honor Tuesday evening at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, Ben-Gvir wrote of the Republicans, quote, they express support for my very clear position on how to act in Gaza and that the food and aid depots should be bombed in order to create military and political pressure to bring our hostages home safely, Ben-Gvir wrote in remarks translated from Hebrew. Separately, Ben-Gvir was confronted by student protesters and others on Wednesday after attending an event near Yale University. This all comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returned to a Tel Aviv courtroom this week to give testimony as he faces three separate corruption cases. Netanyahu is charged with fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes. Authorities in Indian-administered Kashmir say they've identified three suspects in Tuesday's deadly assault on tourists in the resort town of Pahalgam, which killed 26 people and injured more than a dozen others, most of them Indian nationals. Two of the three suspects are Pakistanis. In the wake of the attack, India closed its main border with Pakistan and canceled visas for Pakistani visitors, ordering them to leave India within 48 hours. India also canceled a landmark water treaty with Pakistan and summoned Pakistan's top diplomat to New Delhi amidst growing tensions between the nuclear-armed neighbors. Overnight, Russian missile attacks killed at least eight people in Kyiv in Russia's deadliest strikes on Ukraine's capital since last summer. Dozens of others were wounded. The attack came as the Trump administration's been threatening to withdraw from peace talks. On Wednesday, Trump demanded Kyiv accept a plan that would allow Russia to maintain territory it's gained during its three-year-long invasion of Ukraine and barring NATO membership for Kyiv. The plan has been rejected by President Volodymyr Zelensky. The federal judge overseeing the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father who was sent to a prison in El Salvador after an administrative error, granted the Trump administration an additional week to share what steps it's taking to ensure his return. Meanwhile, Abrego Garcia's wife had to be moved to a safe house after the Department of Homeland Security posted her address online, sharing a photo of a 2021 protective order that featured her home address. Federal immigration agents in Florida have opened Operation Tidal Wave, a first-of-its-kind coordinated effort with state police that's seeking to arrest 800 undocumented immigrants this week. Some 230 Florida law enforcement agencies have signed on to an initiative that allows ICE to deputize officers to act as immigration agents. In Vermont, agents with U.S. Customs and Border Protection raided the state's largest dairy farm on Monday, arresting 8 immigrant workers who've since been jailed at the Northwest State Correctional Facility. It's the largest immigration enforcement action in Vermont's recent history. The Republican Governor Phil Scott responded to the raid by calling on Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform, writing in a statement, quote, "Migrant workers are an essential part of our communities. They are our neighbors and friends, have kids in our schools, shop at our businesses, and play an important role in our economy and workforce," Governor Scott said. In Southern California, the Department of Homeland Security says its agents arrested 10 people at a raid on day laborers gathered outside a Home Depot store in Pomona Tuesday morning. This comes as advocates are raising alarm over the targeting of Southeast Asian immigrants in Los Angeles and Orange County. In the months since Trump returned to office, ICE has detained a growing number of Cambodian, Laotian, and Vietnamese immigrants, even though their deportation orders had been placed on indefinite hold, sometimes for several decades. Here in New York, immigrant delivery workers rallied outside the headquarters of DoorDash Wednesday to demand the food delivery app cease its predatory labor practices, including wage theft. The protest was organized by Los Deliveristas Unidas. This is Santos Suk, a 25-year-old delivery worker who's owed nearly $2,000 in wages by DoorDash dating back to 2022.
It's not fair that they steal our wages. We want to work. We have families in our home countries, and our wages help support our families. We are here to demand justice from DoorDash. They are multimillionaires, and it's unacceptable that they owe us money. We face many risks. People think our work is easy. It's not. We risk our lives in the snow, in the rain, in the heat, in traffic. My message to my fellow immigrants is, do not be afraid. We have to keep going. We are here to fight.
Earlier this year, DoorDash was ordered to pay nearly $17 million for unlawfully using customer tips to subsidize the wages of its delivery workers. A dozen states, including New York and Oregon, have sued President Trump over his, quote, arbitrary imposed tariffs on Wednesday, arguing such decisions must be made by Congress. This comes a week after California launched its own tariff lawsuit. On Wednesday, President Trump suggested he could reimpose what he called reciprocal tariffs on some countries in 2 to 3 weeks if they fail to make a deal with him soon. Share prices of President Trump's meme coins surged by over 50% Wednesday after the cryptocurrency's website announced its top 220 investors would be invited to attend a private gala dinner hosted by Trump. The promotion also offers a, quote, ultra-exclusive VIP reception with the president and a White House tour for the top 25 Trump meme coin investors. The anti-corruption group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, known as CREW, called the promotion, quote, one of the most blatant and appalling instances of selling access to the presidency we've ever seen, unquote. The European Union fined Apple and Meta $800 million for violating the Digital Markets Act, a new law designed to prevent anti-competitive practices by big tech. Meta is accused of forcing users to either pay for Facebook and Instagram subscriptions or to make their personal data available to advertisers. Trump has threatened to retaliate against European regulations on U.S. tech companies. Prosecutors and defense attorneys made opening statements Wednesday in a retrial of Harvey Weinstein on rape charges. The disgraced movie mogul was convicted of rape in 2020, but that landmark ruling was later overturned due to a judge's error. This time around, the case will be heard by a majority female jury. This trial will also feature a newly added allegation by former model Kaya Sokola, who accuses Weinstein of forcing oral sex on her in 2006. Sokola's attorney spoke to reporters after Wednesday's opening arguments here in New York.
The Me Too movement is alive and well. There's been incredible changes in legislation surrounding sexual assault. I think as a society, we are starting to have a better collective understanding about the trauma that sexual assault survivors have faced. And we are able to differentiate these rape myths and the victim blaming, which is a tactic that Weinstein's lawyers have used in this trial.
In media news, the longstanding executive producer of CBS's 60 Minutes has quit. Bill Owens wrote in a memo to his staff, quote, "It has become clear that I would not be allowed to run the show as I have always run it, to make independent decisions based on what was right for 60 Minutes, right for the audience," he said. Trump is suing CBS for $20 billion over a segment last year he said was edited to be favorable to Kamala Harris. It was an interview with her they edited down. In January, the New York Times reported CBS's parent company, Paramount, could reach a settlement with Trump in that case. Trump has also called for CBS to lose its broadcasting license after airing pieces on Ukraine and Greenland he disagreed with. Meanwhile, a planned $8 billion merger between Paramount and Skydance Media is currently awaiting FCC approval. Skydance's CEO, David Ellison, is the son of billionaire Larry Ellison, co-founder of Oracle and a close Trump ally. In Michigan, FBI agents and local police raided the homes of University of Michigan Palestinian rights activists in Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, and Canton on Wednesday. The targets of the raids participated in campus anti-war protests. Attorney General Dana Nessel claims they're part of a vandalism investigation. Rights groups condemned the raids, with the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, asserting, quote, "peaceful dissent is not a crime," unquote. In California, a group of students at Occidental College are entering their fourth day of a hunger strike to demand Occidental divest from companies tied to Israel's slaughter in Gaza, protect free speech on campus, and shield students from attacks by ICE and the LAPD. These are some of the striking students speaking Wednesday.
Today marks day 3 of our hunger strike and day 564 of Israel's most recent intensification of the 77-year genocide against the Palestinian people. Since March, Israel has been enforcing a man-made blockade and creating a famine.
Occidental College is complicit in this ongoing genocide, and we as the students are committed to holding the administration accountable to being on the right side of history.
In more higher education news, colleges belonging to what's known as the Big Ten Alliance are establishing a mutual defense compact to fight back against Trump's escalating legal, financial, and political attacks on universities. Those who already voted to sign on to the pact include Rutgers and University of Michigan. The Washington Post reports the Trump administration is preparing to remove federal protections for at least 6 national monuments spanning millions of acres of land across Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Utah. This comes as the Interior Department is moving to fast-track approvals for coal, gas, oil, and mineral projects on public lands and waters, reducing the typical length of an environmental review to just 14 or 28 weeks, down from 1 to 2 years. The Trump administration is justifying the change by its declaration of a so-called energy emergency. Environmental groups have vowed to sue to block the move. A new report by the American Lung Association finds nearly half of people in the U.S. are breathing in dangerous levels of air pollutants. Scientists say larger and more frequent wildfires triggered by the climate crisis have contributed to the nation's worsening air quality crisis. And in more environmental news, the worst ever recorded event of coral bleaching has spread to 84% of the world's reefs. The bleaching, brought about by global heating, seriously threatens oceanic biodiversity and could lead to the death of vital underwater ecosystems. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. President Trump is facing increasing criticism from corporate America over his decision to launch a global trade war. On Monday, the CEOs of Walmart, Target, and Home Depot met with Trump at the White House to warn about the impact of Trump's trade policies. A day later, Trump signaled he's open to substantially lowering tariffs on China. Trump is also toning down his attacks on Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, who he'd threatened to fire. This all comes as global stock markets remain in turmoil over Trump's trade policies. The Wall Street Journal reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average is headed for its worst April performance since the Great Depression.
We're joined now by Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. His most recent piece is headlined Trump Blinks. Kuttner's latest book is Going Big, FDR's Legacy, Biden's New Deal, and the Struggle to Save Democracy. Robert Kuttner is also a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. Robert, welcome back to Democracy Now! So let's begin with this U-turn, with this reversal of Trump's. When he started talking about 145% tariffs on China, it was like someone else had proposed them and he wanted to turn that around. So you've got from China to the possible firing of Jerome Powell and the turnaround on that. Can you talk about the significance of this and what it means that the Dow Jones is plummeting to the point of being compared to the Great Depression?
Well, Amy, I've been obsessively concerned with one question. Where are the firewalls? Where are the speed bumps? How might we slow Trump down? And there are maybe three or four ways that we can do this. One is by activism. One is by the Supreme Court, remembering that its job is to protect the rule of law, and that seems to be happening. And one is financial markets. Now, as someone who spent my entire career criticizing the power of Wall Street, it doesn't give me great pleasure that financial markets can be a source of restraint on Trump. On the other hand, in World War II, you know, we had an alliance with Stalin to beat Hitler. So you take the allies you can take. And what's happened in the past few days, and Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, is the interesting figure here. Markets crashed, first of all, when Trump declared Liberation Day and tried to impose tariffs on the whole world. They crashed again when he made noises about firing Jerome Powell. They crashed again when he did this lunacy with China. And what Bessent has done, he's sort of the most conventional Wall Street guy of all of Trump's advisors. So he kind of speaks for financial markets. And he basically said to Trump, you really don't want to do this. And so Trump walked it back. And if you look at markets, financial markets, the Dow Jones, the S&P 500 in the past few days, you know, they've bounced around like a yo-yo, and they've bounced around primarily in response to whether Trump is doubling down on this craziness or whether he's backing off.
And you've said, Robert, that Scott Bessent plays the role of the, quote, sole grown-up in the room in the Trump administration.
Right.
So if you could say a little bit about his background and what kind of influence you think he has on Trump.
It's very interesting. I mean, he is the most atypical of all of the close-in Trump advisors. He used to be a Democrat. He worked for George Soros for a long time. He's the guy who came up with a bet that crashed the pound in the mid-90s. And then he set up his own hedge fund. He's gay. He's married to a man. He's about as unlike most of MAGA as he could be. And Trump picked him because he wanted one traditional Wall Street guy to reassure financial markets. And Bessent has not been shy about using this influence to kind of talk Trump off the ledge and get him to back off some of the crazier stuff. Now, we'll see whether Bessent's days are numbered, right? Because Trump is paranoid about loyalty. He's petulant. He could turn on Bessent. But I think for the moment, he's following Bessent's advice. Now, here's the complication. It's sort of easy to say, okay, I'm not going to fire Jerome Powell. It's much harder to do a deal with China. China plays a long game much better than we do, as I wrote. China's time horizon is measured in centuries, if not millennia. And Trump's attention span is measured in hours, if not days. And you don't just do a deal with China. China has an entire economic system based on mercantilism, so-called industrial policy, using state subsidies to build the world's second most powerful economy, soon to be the world's most powerful economy. You don't just have a stage meeting with Xi Jinping and say, okay, we'll cut the tariffs and you change your whole economic and political system. That's not how it works. So it's not clear what kind of deal is in the offing. And Trump has basically weakened his own hand by doing this ridiculous 145% tariffs, and then humiliatingly having to walk it back. So Xi's hand is stronger than it was before Trump did this.
And if you could explain, actually, what do you think happened? Because, I mean, just to clarify, the tariffs that Trump had imposed on China were at 145%. China retaliated by imposing 125% on American goods to China. Then he says earlier this week to reporters in the Oval Office that tariffs on China will, quote, come down substantially, saying, he said, we're going to be very nice and they're going to be very nice and we'll see what happens. And then China today came out and said, actually, there are no negotiations going on between the U.S. and China on that, and much less has there been any agreement.
Well, exactly. So a lot of what Trump is saying is in the realm of wishful thinking. And the reason he backed off is that so many American consumer goods, American producer goods like auto parts, are intimately bound up with sources of supply that come from China. Now, think about what 145% tariffs mean. That means that if something costs $100, it suddenly costs $100 plus 145% of $100. So it now costs $245. That's tantamount to a boycott. It's like a complete boycott of Chinese exports. And after all these years of neoliberalism, where so much stuff gets outsourced to China, we're very dependent on China. The flip side, and this has to do with China's retaliatory tariffs, our biggest export is, guess what? It's soybeans. It's 9% of all of American exports, not farm exports, all exports. And the biggest customer for American soybeans is China. Well, if China's tariffs are over 100% on American soybeans, China's going to start getting its soybeans from Brazil or from Argentina. So you've got farmers very upset as well. And you've got all of industry and all of agriculture telling Trump, back off, don't do this to us. So, of course, he has to back off. And China's in the catbird seat, and China can very well say, well, we don't have any deals pending. We didn't do this. He did this. And he's weaker than it was before he was before. And this is classic Trump. You create a crisis, then you say, well, actually, I'm going to back off and the crisis is over. And you end up with yourself and the country worse than before you started.
And then, of course, the question is how much he and his friends make when he suddenly does a turnaround and the stock market goes up. Robert Kuttner, 10 seconds to respond to that.
Well, he's totally corrupt. He doesn't make any bones about the fact that he's totally corrupt. You had the item about cryptocurrencies. I mean, he's the ultimate grifter.
As in grifter, not to be confused with drifter, Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. We're going to link to your piece, Trump Blinks, but stay with us because we want to talk about your other piece, Is the Press Next? We'll speak with Robert Kuttner and the Nobel Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa. She knows something about corruption and pressure on the press coming from the Philippines. Stay with us. Mohaya, Will You Remember, by Filipino singer Eva Eugenio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We're continuing our conversation with Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, to talk about another of his recent articles. This one headlined, "Is the Press Next?" Kuttner writes, quote, "As Trump tries to destroy one free institution after another, universities, law firms, independent public agencies, trade unions, sooner or later he will come for the press," Kuttner writes. And Trump's attacks on the press have already begun. In December, ABC News settled a defamation suit filed by President-elect Trump instead of taking the case to court. As part of the deal, ABC will donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library. The White House has also banned the Associated Press from covering some presidential events over its refusal to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. After suffering a court setback, the White House moved to restrict access to all of the wire services.
President Trump has also repeatedly attacked 60 Minutes, CBS's flagship investigative news program. Trump has urged the Federal Communications Commission to pull CBS's license. And in his personal capacity, Trump has filed a $20 billion lawsuit against CBS over how 60 Minutes edited an interview with Kamala Harris last year. This all comes as CBS's parent company, Paramount Global, is seeking FCC approval for its proposed $8 billion merger with Skydance Media. Earlier this week, there was a major shakeup at 60 Minutes. The show's executive producer, Bill Owens, resigned, saying, quote, "Over the past months, it's become clear that I would not be allowed to run the show as I have always run it, to make independent decisions based on what was right for 60 Minutes, right for the audience," he said. Semaphore has reported Paramount's Shari Redstone had begun personally keeping tabs on 60 Minutes segments about Trump. Robert Kuttner of The American Prospect is still with us, along with Maria Ressa, co-founder and CEO of the Philippine independent news site Rappler, who received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2021 for her work defending free expression in the Philippines. Robert Kuttner, we're going to start with you laying out what is taking place here when you have 60 Minutes head leaving, saying he can no longer ensure its independence, and you have this merger that Shari Redstone is trying to accomplish with Larry Ellison, the Oracle founder, and his son, David Ellison, known Trump allies. Talk about all of this.
Well, my worry is that this is just the beginning. If they wanted to become really systematic in this article, "Is the Press Next?", I ticked off all the things they might do. So the first thing they might do is they might go after the nonprofit tax-exempt status of much of the progressive media, so-called 501c3 status, that allows you to get foundation grants. And to be a 501c3, you're not supposed to be political. And, you know, just between us and your audience, a lot of the left press is pretty tough on Trump, as it ought to be. So Trump could go to the it's illegal for the president to, abruptly pull the tax exemption of any organization. But you could get the IRS to launch an investigation, and you could find that, shock, several progressive media are actually pretty critical of Trump, and maybe they don't deserve a 501c3 status. That, in turn, would spook their foundations, because they're also 501c3s. They're tax exempt, and you could threaten their tax exemption. So that's just one thing he could do. You already have a kind of anticipatory capitulation, appeasement on the part of big corporate owners of the Washington Post and the LA Times, and sometimes the New York Times feels like it's pulling its punches, because when a billionaire owns a media property, I hate the word, they have their other business interests to look out for, Shari Redstone being a classical example. So you've got self-censorship. That's a second evil. You've also got the fact that, you know, public broadcasting broadcasts on frequencies that are allocated by the FCC. The FCC could say, hey, actually, we need those frequencies for national security purposes, and public radio stations, you don't get to broadcast over the air anymore.
And so, Congress has already started an investigation into PBS and NPR.
That's correct. So Trump could play hardball. Now, the good news here is this is protected by the First Amendment. And in the last segment, we talked about briefly the Supreme Court discovering the fact that its primary job is to uphold the rule of law, and it doesn't get any more fundamental than the First Amendment. So that might slow down Trump. The other interesting thing is that more and more and more Americans get their news, regardless of what the original news source is, from the internet. They don't read newspapers anymore. And a lot of listeners to public radio listen on the internet. It's harder to censor the internet. And you could imagine media gravitating to the internet. Even the Chinese Communist Party had trouble creating what was called the Great Firewall of China to keep Chinese citizens from accessing the internet. So I don't think he's going to put the free press out of business, but I think we need to be vigilant.
Well, I'd like to get Maria Ressa to comment on what's happening in the U.S. as well. Of course, you have devoted your life to fighting for free expression in the Philippines, for which you were awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 2021. So if you could talk first about your site, Rappler, the repeated attempts by the Duterte government to have you imprisoned, several, 10, I believe, arrest warrants issued against you, and how, despite all of that, you kept Rappler running throughout.
Yeah, no, first, thank you for having me. But, you know, let me just be a little bit more dire than Robert. I just came from the Perugia, from the International Journalism Festival, where VDEM, which does kind of a rating of all democracies globally, right? Their latest report now says that 72% of the world is under autocratic rule. Like, we have elected illiberal leaders in 72% in these democracies around the world, right?
Well, but, how do they classify the U.S.?
The U.S. is, so here's what he said. The head of VDEM publicly said that if the trends in America continue, that he expects democracy to die by the summer. Like, not just to wake you up, right? Like, literally. And actually, if we stop normalizing the death by a thousand cuts of rule of law, you can see this happening, right? For the Turkish grad student picked up from the streets, from Tufts University, from all of the little things. We've talked here about the press. The press was attacked in the first Trump administration, right? Duterte echoed President Trump. President Trump echoed Duterte. Enemies of the people. That's what they both called us. But the point here is, we normalize new depths. Like, we should not be where we are, and yet that's where we are. And what are you seeing being created? At the early days, in the first month, I called it the Philippinization of American politics, but I think it's even worse, because what you're seeing, not many mainstream media covered the government pausing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, right? Saying, essentially telling Americans that it's okay to be corrupt because you need to be competitive. These are the ideals that are being broken down. So what are we seeing? We're seeing the creation of a kleptocracy. The last part here is, Robert talked about the internet, but these big tech companies, the broligarchy, who were there in the front row, right?
At his inauguration.
The design of social media, and this was a clip you ran in the tease at the beginning, it literally turns the incentive structure upside down, is on the side of a populist dictate, a dictator to be, right? Because why? In 2018, MIT said that lies spread 6 times faster. That was before Elon Musk bought Twitter and turned it to X and turned it into a human cesspool, even worse than it was in 2018. So if lies spread 6 times faster, and fear, anger, and hate, this is across the world. If you use fear, anger, and hate, it spreads I put rabbit ears on information. The post spreads virally. Right? So there are more ways. Online violence is real world violence. The reason why 72% of the world today is now under authoritarian rule is partly because our public information ecosystem is corrupted. Good morning.
I remember you being on the show here years ago when Duterte was really going after you, when he was the leader of the Philippines now, and we'll talk about this in a moment.
Yes.
He's in prison at The Hague. But when you walked out, you said, don't take this as just an example of, you know, this sort of story of the Philippines. She said, you said, this could be happening to you in just a few years. I see us as a warning for you. So talk about, I mean, Nermeen mentioned how many times they attempted to arrest you. Talk about how you dealt with this and how you fought back, because I think law firms are seeing, universities are seeing, all of these institutions, when they fight back, Trump blinks.
So first, I think the biggest lesson we learned is that you are at your most powerful at the beginning of the attacks. Every day you do not fight back, you lose just a little bit more of your rights. We normalize just a little bit more of this kind of pseudo-democracy, right? We are, so we need to, I think the first is that, what are the steps, right? Social media was used to attack us, and it's like fertilizer. Saying you're the enemy of the press then lets people believe that's astroturfing. For me, hashtag arrest Maria Ressa was trended by pro-government, by pro-Duterte information operations 2 years before I was actually arrested. And that sets the stage. It's like fertilizer. So social media, then media capture, and Robert talked about the chilling effect. Forget the chilling, it's Siberia. And business interest, I talked about the three C's, corrupt, coerce, co-opt. For every single institution that is broken down, media, academe, NGO capture, state capture. And each step of the way as you go down, rule of law breaks down and you lose. It's death by a thousand cuts of your rights. So in the Philippines, you know, it was a rallying cry for us because I'm a traditional journalist in the old sense of the word, right? Like, and I didn't want to be an activist, but when it's a battle for facts, journalism is activism. So in our case, I said, we hold the line. This is the line where the Constitution gives us our rights. The Philippines, like the United States, has three branches, co-equal branches of government, and the United States is following the Philippines. What happened under Duterte, a very powerful executive, a co-opted legislature, and it took Duterte 6 months to crush the checks and balances of the Philippines to get rid of institutional checks on his power. The judiciary, what happens with the judiciary is not only, you talked about the 10 arrest warrants I have, 8 years later, we've won 8 of the 10 cases, but I still have to ask for the Philippines, for approval to travel from the Philippine Supreme Court. What rights you lose today, you will not get back, right? Like, this is part of the reason why, if you value your rights, you stand up for them, you hold the line. Because silence is complicity. Silence gives approval for it. And we create a new normal. Even reporting has to slightly change. You have to call a lie a lie. You have to put the context to it. And anyway, sorry, I can talk about this forever. I feel like I have PTSD and deja vu all combined. You know, it's shocking America is where it is today.
But tell us, so what happened with Rappler? There were constant attempts to shut it down, but somehow you moved the servers abroad, or you did something to make sure that despite the crackdown on the media, you were able to continue running.
We prepared, right? You embrace your fear. And you once I figured out what were the worst case scenarios we could have, we workflowed. I mean, Rappler is small. It's 100, 120 people. And we told our people very early on when the government first tried to shut us down in January 2018, you may not want to be here. This is going to be a different thing. Everyone has a different risk appetite, right? So we gave our reporters the option to leave Rappler because I said, we'll help place you in another news organization. Not one reporter took that, right? And the other part is once you know who you are and what you stand for and you're ready for the worst case, then you stand up for your rights. I think that's the challenge today. And in how to stand up to a dictator, the question I asked Filipinos and I now ask, the reason why I thought it was coming for every democracy around the world is this tech is global. You know, what it proved is that we could all be manipulated in the exact same way, regardless of country or culture. It was like looking at Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Oh, my God. And we're allowing this to happen. They're doing it with impunity for profit. So hold the line.
don't give up your rights, because you only get weaker over time.
So you win the Nobel Peace Prize. You travel the world talking about freedom of the press, and Duterte's in jail. Let's talk about this. Former President Rodrigo Duterte was flown to The Hague after being arrested in Manila for crimes against humanity on an international criminal court warrant. The ICC has been investigating Duterte since 2018, as you have, or even further back, over his extrajudicial so-called war on drugs that the UN estimates killed over 8,600 people. Human rights groups in the Philippines say the death toll is more like 30,000. Many children were among those killed. Last year, the former president admitted under oath he oversaw a death squad of gangsters while he served as mayor of the southern city of Davao. Can you talk about what this means for the Philippines?
Well, it doesn't end, right? The fight. So what is it? How did he get arrested? It was the work of so many families, so many victims who refused to be victims. And over time, it took that long. And part of it was also Gaza, right? We were told, we've been looking for this since August of 20, my gosh, when was that? 2022. Right. Soon after the pandemic. So it took a long time, a lot of work, a focus on justice. And I think the interesting thing here is that what's at stake for the world today is whether or not an international rules-based order still exists, whether it's Ukraine or Gaza or tech. Right. And then what the Philippines proved is that, and people will say, well, it's power politics. Everything is power politics. What the Philippines proved is that little Philippines actually honored an ICC, the very first time a Filipino president has been charged with crimes against humanity. When he was arrested, I was in the Philippines when that happened. We broke the story in Rappler for the arrest warrant. And when that happened, we didn't know what was going to happen. And I think that's the part, you know, I really want to tell Americans that you take step by step towards the goal of your values, towards the rights you have, and you don't know what will happen. It's incredibly uncertain. There were times I thought I would go to jail. There were times I had to wear a bulletproof vest in the car, right? So, but you hold tight. And I think that's what, I lost my right to travel. Five times I couldn't travel. Then the Nobel Prize happened and I could travel, but I've still lost some rights. Sorry, the Philippines proved that an international human rights-based order can exist. But we have elections. It's 2 weeks. May 12th, our elections, midterm elections. It's a battle between Marcos and Duterte, the president and his vice president. And
Duterte's daughter.
Duterte's daughter. And Duterte, now in prison at The Hague, has been given a boost. The massive disinformation that has come to the Philippines, Rappler has done three or four stories to track this disinformation, that even though Filipinos know we're being manipulated online, we continue to get manipulated because it's our emotions, right? If Duterte's allies win at the Senate, his daughter is facing impeachment charges, corruption. Again, kleptocracy, it is power and money, right? This is where the world is headed. Hello. And then what happens is if his allies win, Sara Duterte may actually then survive the impeachment, may not lose her post. And that means that's a setup again for another Duterte for our presidential elections. It doesn't end, but the fight for your rights continues. Are you going to be silent? And here's the last part. Fear is real. I mean, in the Philippines, there were an average of 8 dead bodies dumped on the sidewalk every night. We had one reporter going out every night, right? So fear is real. And there were times I was angry at Filipinos for not doing more. But we kept going. And I think the Philippines shows you that it could take a while, but justice does happen. But it depends on what happens in America now, right? Where the world goes. It's still true what happens to America. America catches a cold, so does the entire world, right? So look at the markets, as you've said. Anyway, hold on to your rights. I'm worried about 2025 and where the world will take us.
Well, Maria, we also want to ask you about the death of Pope Francis.
Thousands of mourners are lining up again today as Pope Francis's body lies in state in St. Peter's Basilica. His funeral will be on Saturday. You met with the Pope, Pope Francis, several times at the Vatican, including most recently in January at the World Communications Jubilee, where you delivered the opening speech. We're just going to play a clip.
Because we are at the Vatican, I want to point out three things. First, technology rewards lies. Think about that. The first time I met Pope Francis, I said, Pope Francis, it's against the Ten Commandments. Two, the men who control this transformative technology wield godlike power, but they're far from God.
So that was Maria Ressa, the Nobel laureate, speaking at the Vatican with Pope Francis in the audience. It was, what, January 27th. Talk about what Pope Francis means to you. Philippines is a Catholic country. And why he was also so concerned about the media.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, I would be what you'd call a wayward Catholic. I mean, you know, I believed in God, but I didn't like the way governance in the five major world religions happen, right? The manipulation, the lack of rights for women, I mean, whatever. But Pope Francis called us about 20 to 30 Nobel Peace Prize winners. And around 2023, we met with him and came out. He thought the world was going crazy, right? War. He stood up against he asked for peace in Ukraine, in Gaza, in all the different.
He called for a ceasefire in Gaza Sunday, Easter, right before he died.
Exactly. And beyond that, this is a pope that understood the role of artificial intelligence. I mean, it was interesting sitting around a table where, you know, you could see all of the world's problems that were existential, from landmines to climate change to nuclear proliferation to, oh my gosh, what would be the next one? I mean, I was at the last in terms of technology and media, right? He understood this. He stood up for the principles that were there. And even for the marginalized, this was a progressive pope. He was inclusive in a way the church had not been. And I think even small things like we quibbled over the word fraternity, right? Because it's sexist in nature, but it's very hard to change an entire Catholic church. So look, I think what he did with us, I was sitting next to Shirin Ebadi from Iran, Tawakkol Karman. It was from Yemen. The first Arab woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize in the Arab Spring, right? And we all came together to demand peace, unity, and press freedom was also something Pope Francis, look, it was a choice. The Jubilee happens once every 25 years for the Catholic Church. And the first speaker he chose, despite the relentless coverage of sexual abuse, both of minors and of women in the Catholic Church, right? Despite all of that, and men, he chose journalists to kick off the Jubilee. Mm. He cared about what was happening around the world. And now, this conservative ally of progressive values, now we're going to see what will happen at the conclave. Who will replace Pope Francis? The church is a powerful force. I guess this is what he taught me, is that faith is incredibly important when you're fighting for your rights.
Two Filipinos are being considered to be the next pope.
Oh, my God. So I knew one. Who's the second?
I don't know which one you know, and I probably don't know the name of the second.
Okay. I know that three Filipinos for the first time, this is huge for the Philippines, are joining the conclave. Mm-hmm. And that was the other thing Pope Francis did, right? He changed the church by changing the people. He moved it away from a Eurocentric kind of global north view, and he brought in Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Asia, right? So the one that, you know, that has been tipped, and of course, I've been to the Vatican now
like four times in less than 2 years, because when Pope Francis calls, you go, right? And what the whisper, of course, is, and he may be as high as number two, is that Cardinal Tagle, he moved to Rome because the Pope Francis gave him a special, like he changed the rules. He gave him a special appointment to come to Rome. Mm. And Cardinal Tagle, I believe, is just behind.
We're showing his picture with you.
We were doing this is at the Vatican. And this man is very liberal, progressive. He speaks normally. Again, very, I know him quite well because when I first took over as head of the largest network in the Philippines, Cardinal Tagle had a program on ABS-CBN. Sorry, back to ABS-CBN. The largest broadcaster in the Philippines lost its franchise to operate under Duterte. Franchise is like a license to operate. It never regained it, even after Duterte was gone. I'm just saying, you can cut the deals, corporate media, but once you empower a dictator, you lose these rights.
Mm-hmm. We want to thank you so much for being with us. Certainly an important warning you once again share with us here in the United States. Maria Ressa, co-founder and CEO of the Philippine independent news site Rappler, received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2021 for her work defending free expression in the Philippines as the president at the time, Duterte, went after, attempted to arrest her over and over and over again. We also want to thank Robert Kuttner, the American Prospect. Coming up, Trump administration's war on children. Back in 30 seconds. Birds Lament by Moondog. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheh.
We end today's show looking at what ProPublica calls the Trump administration's war on children. Their new report looks at how the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, is putting children at risk by cutting funds for investigating child abuse, enforcing child support payments, providing child care, and more.
We're joined now by ProPublica reporter Eli Hager. So, Eli, lay out your findings.
Well, it's probably been a little bit hard for people to follow all of these cuts across all of these different federal agencies. But one through line that we've tracked at ProPublica is cuts to programs serving children. So across a lot of little known federal agencies with names like the Children's Bureau and the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, there have been cuts to both funding and services and staffing for child protective services, for enforcing child support orders, for child care and all sorts of programs. And the through line has been that those programs serve children.
And Eli, could you say, we'll get into each of the programs that you list in the piece, but why do you think this hasn't been given so much publicity? People aren't aware of how much poor children are being made to suffer by these cuts, or will be.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. I think one is just the chaos and the onslaught of cuts at so many different agencies. I think a number of these agencies are relatively anonymous agencies that people haven't heard of. And they're also housed within very large departments like the Health and Human Services and Department of Justice. And these are smaller children's offices within those large departments. And I also just don't think people realize how much the federal government does for children's services and for administering things like CPS and adoption across the country and things like
Let's start with Head Start. I mean, this is astounding. Goes to 1 million low-income parents. What this means, eliminating the Lyndon Johnson program from the war on poverty.
Right. There's Head Start in every community across the country. This would especially affect rural areas where often the Head Start program is the only child care facility or location in a whole town. And so 1 million working parents across the country wouldn't have anywhere to send their children during the day if Head Start were to be ended, which the president's budget calls for. Also, these Head Start program directors have been having trouble accessing their congressionally appropriated funds. They're being directed to a DOGE Defend the Spend website, which seems to be new.
This, as Elon Musk calls for people to have more children, they're talking about actually spending money, giving $5,000 a piece to women who give birth to children.
Right. Yes, that is an irony that we noticed.
And you also talk about in the piece the other areas that have been impacted, including cuts to institutions that investigate child sexual abuse and internet crimes against children, responding to reports of missing children, and preventing youth violence. If you could elaborate on some of those, like where, under what organization or department do those fall?
Right. So what we noticed was that it wasn't just cuts to kind of these more liberal coded programs like support for child care and direct assistance to lower income families with children, but also these programs that have much more support across the political spectrum, like funds and staffing for investigating child abuse and child protective services. A lot of that is funded by the Social Services Block Grant, and the entire staff that delivers that block grant was laid off by Robert F. Kennedy at HHS. And then you also at the Department of Justice have cuts to or delayed or blocked funding for local law enforcement to investigate internet crimes against children, for programs that respond to cases of missing children, for Amber Alerts, for all of these things that respond to very serious cases of violence against children.
And talk about the cutting off of health care for what, some 800,000 children? And then, of course, with the threats to Medicaid, the millions of children covered by Medicaid.
Yeah, I think one thing that people don't realize is that children are actually they receive Medicaid in greater numbers than any other age group. Nearly 40% of the people who rely on Medicaid are children, whether that's in school-based healthcare or in foster care or residential facilities, whether it's for their disabilities or for cancer treatment. The potential cuts to Medicaid would be devastating to children across the country.
And is there any recourse that these agencies have? I mean, are these cuts inevitable and going into effect?
So it depends on which one. The cuts to Head Start to staffing and potentially to its funding seem imminent, and Head Start programs are already closing in several parts of the country. That's probably one of the more imminent ones. The cuts at DOJ for local law enforcement seem like they may happen, but there's a chance that some of that funding gets reinstated. The department said that they're still considering some of the grants. So there's a spectrum. Obviously, we know that with Medicaid, that's still up in the air, but it looks like the Republicans in Congress are going to be cutting Medicaid.
And you got a response from Robert Kennedy's office, of course, in charge of Health in America, saying they're going to put money into establishing MAHA, right, the Administration for Healthy America.
Right. They're going to consolidate all these children's programs at the Administration for Children and Families that had run child care and Head Start and the child support system. It's another big one that the federal government does. It makes sure that child support payments get to families. All of those are going to be reduced and consolidated into this other area.
Well, Eli Hager, we're going to have to leave it to folks reading your piece. Eli Hager is a ProPublica reporter. We'll link to his new piece, The Trump Administration's War on children. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!